The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Oh, yeah. He said he had two cats. Oh, shit. Well, I guess that's not a sin anymore. But it's still a sin in my heart.
Welcome to Gold, Diamonds, and Death, a James Bond podcast. I'm your 00 host, Jonathan Watkins. I am a writer for all things under the CinemaSins brand name and a co-host of the Behind the Sins podcast. Joining me each and every week for this endeavor, he's the co-founder of CinemaSins, co-host of the weekly podcast Wreckatopia. His favorite stuffed animal is Doo-Doo.
Yes.
And he's also one of my good friends, Mr. Chris Atkinson.
Just be sure that everybody knows there's a U at the end of that.
Yeah.
Because, boy, that would be really embarrassing. I mean, it's still embarrassing. Anyway.
Well, that could just be how you spell it.
Could be.
We don't know.
Could be.
Doo-Doo. Mm-hmm. That's, by the way, maybe the most adorable child I've ever seen in any film ever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think she gives Jerry Maguire kid a run for his money.
I think so.
Plus, I think that kid turned out to be kind of I don't know. He's probably very nice. I'm not going to make fun of I'm not going to make fun of Jonathan Lipnicki. He's probably awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, hello, we are talking about the 27th, and I guess, I don't know if you call this our first season, I'm not sure what we call it. I guess technically it is, this is our season finale, because this is the last film, so at this point in time, when we are recording in 2023, the last Bond film that exists is No Time to Die, which I might call Die Another Day, because I keep wanting to call it Die Another Day.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not alike. It's just the title, for some reason, it's got Die in there, mm-hmm. and they kind of like resemble each other, like what they're trying to say. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyways, that might happen. But yeah, you're doing good. You're excited to talk about this last film?
I am excited to talk about this last film, yes. There are a lot of things to deconstruct about No Time to Die.
There is.
Mm-hmm.
I will say I don't have as much information. I had to find information different ways, because the book that I've been using this whole time, nobody does it better. James Bond guide. They only covered up to Spectre. This came out. Spectre. That's right. Up to Spectre. At the end of the book, it does say that No Time to Die had been announced. It had already been titled, so they did know it was coming, but the book was published before that. So I didn't have the book to go by. So this is all like online. Watched a few interviews, that kind of thing. And tried to hopefully got some stuff that's actually factual and not just like fluff.
Mm-hmm.
But I did my best. So anyways, let's talk about the behind the scenes in a segment we like to call Eon Flux.
This is a journey.
I'm gonna make a movie!
We have to go back, Kate.
Wow, how did you know all that stuff?
I did my research.
I don't understand any of this.
What the fuck is going on?
We are gonna scour through the history of Eon Productions and give you all the highs and lows that went into the makings of these films. No Time to Die. This is the 27th Bond film we're covering, but this is the 25th film in the official franchise. It is also the first James Bond film to be distributed by Universal Pictures. They picked up the international rights after the Sony contract expired. MGM still held on to the domestic, but Universal came in and got the international, which probably worked out a little better for Universal than it did MGM this time around. Although it did make more money domestically than I remembered. Okay, so let's go through this first. This was originally scheduled for release in November of 2019. This movie has a ton of delays. Even pre that thing that happened in 2020.
Yes.
It got postponed to February 2020. It was supposed to come out November of 2019. It got postponed to February 2020 for just, they were still developing it. Then, who I'll talk about Danny Boyle in a second, but Danny Boyle had been hired as a director, and then he left. So then it got postponed again to April 2020. I don't know how they only needed two more months, but that's what it was. And then in 2020, this little thing happened. Maybe some of you have heard of it. It's called COVID.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, if I remember correctly, too, because this was interesting. So all this stuff starts to come down. We're actually about to have our CinemaSins event in 2020 that is called Sin Week, for any of you listening that don't necessarily also watch CinemaSins or know about us. But we were about to have it. So I could remember, you know, during that, like, we didn't know what we were going to do. And I can even remember, like, the night we had, like, our opening night dinner thing we do every year for Sin Week. I go home, and the NBA season has been canceled.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this is getting kind of serious. And then I think maybe like the day before or the next day, I heard that James Bond moved.
Yeah.
I think Godzilla versus Kong too, because I think at one point that was going to be the movie we saw. So I think that had moved too.
Yeah.
Because we ended up having to go see Bloodshot. That was which was probably a lot of people's last movie.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-COVID in the theater. So it was one of those, but this was one of the first major ones where I was like, okay, if they're moving, and it obviously has a lot to do with the international stuff too, because internationally, a lot of things were already shutting down before we did. So I think initially the choice to move had less to do with us and more to do with other countries. But then once we shut down and all the theaters had to start closing and all that stuff, then obviously everything had to start moving. But I remember Bond being one of the first. Do you remember it that way too?
It was one of the first big ones. There were several others out there. What was it? What was the Disney movie that was getting pushed back? Was it Mulan? Mulan was another one that got pushed back, right?
Yeah, it might have been Mulan. Yeah.
I can't remember what the others were, but there were a couple others that were, Onward was the last one I remembered watching in theaters, I think. I think that's the last one I saw in theaters. I'm not sure.
Bloodshot. It would have been Bloodshot. We saw that after Onward.
It was after Onward. So Onward came out,
a week before.
Week before?
It was, yeah.
So after that, yeah, I think the big ones after that were like Mulan was supposed to come out in May. They mm-hmm. kept moving that, and they ended up just coming out with it on Disney Plus, I believe.
Yeah, it might have had a small theatrical release, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it was day and date, if anything,
mm-hmm.
Whenever that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And then like all that stuff, like all the summer stuff started moving. Top Gun, that started its first of several moves. Ghostbusters, Afterlife, Black Widow,
mm-hmm.
I think it came out because it was like a move like a year. Because the only stuff that really ended up coming out was like Tenet.
Yeah.
And that X-Men movie.
The
New Mutants.
New Mutants, which had already been pushed back millions of times anyway.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But mostly when the theaters finally opened back up, they were mostly showing older stuff like Ghostbusters.
And yeah.
And that was kind of fun though. Like you'd have weeks where like Empire Strikes Back was the number one movie. It was kind of wild.
Yeah.
So anyways, April 2020, COVID hits, it gets moved to November 2020, which a lot of these films did this. They moved to the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And then still not a lot of stuff was opening to the point where they thought they were actually going to make the money they needed to make. So it got delayed again to April 2021, and then it got moved even again to October of 2021, which is when it finally starts getting released.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting too. I was trying to, I know I've heard people talk about this, but I couldn't find anything concrete online, but I had heard, and I'm sure this did happen because I think all the streaming services were trying to, get these franchises on their, get these movies on their service. And so they got some pretty lucrative deals. Like they would have made a shit ton of money if they had just sold to a streaming service, but they just refused to do it because, mm-hmm. Bond for 7 decades now, Bond has always been a big theatrical event and they just refused to back down from that. Probably lost money, mm-hmm. but that was more important to them than, and they still made some money. I mean, they didn't lose. I don't know how much they would have lost, but especially worldwide. It premiered at the Royal Albert Hall in London on September 28th, 2021. And then the UK got in wide release on the 30th. And then in the US, it was October 8th. It grossed $774 million worldwide.
Mm.
And $160.9 million was in the US, which made it the lowest box office for a Craig-led Bond film. And it actually made a little less than Die Another Day. It was really close. It was like within a couple hundred thousand.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. But it's still, that was interesting. It did finish 7th at the box office because that was a weird year. More movies that year made $100 million than I thought, but it was still obviously a really odd year, with the exception of like Spider-Man No Way Home, which just was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it finished at seventh. It was between Eternals made a little more and Quiet Place Part 2 made a little less. It's still like the, I think, the fourth highest grossing like current Bond, like without inflation. It's still, you know, in that area of like top four or five. Which all these Craig films basically were. But a lot of it had to do with the worldwide, you know, release. Okay, so, yeah, so that's it on the release. The development for this began all the way back in 2016. In 2017, Neil Purvis and Robert Wade were hired. They map out the story like they've been doing for the last few. Sam Mendes did not want to return. I did read a couple places that Christopher Nolan was a name they were tossing about. I couldn't really figure out if he actually turned it down, though, or if it was just something that was being mentioned.
Well, besides, he was making his own Bond film, a quote-unquote, exactly, with Tenet, so, you know.
I just can't imagine him agreeing to do a Bond film, because he would, unless they let him make it like he wanted to make it.
Yeah.
Which it probably would have been basically what Tenet was, and it would have been very confusing.
Yeah.
That's a movie I'd need to watch again, because it was really interesting to me when you and I can't remember who you sent it with, you and Aaron maybe, and you guys just talking about, you know, going back and rewatching it and watching the interviews. It just, I don't know. I need to watch.
Never
that
done
again.
So much research into a movie on a Sins video, but
and I don't know that you should have to. I mean, I feel like that's a negative on the movie in a way, but I do understand also people say they like the fact that it makes you think, it makes you try to figure out.
Well, yeah, I just didn't want to send it and just, we always sort of plead ignorance on all these Sins videos anyway.
Yeah.
And we could have done it that way, but I really wanted to know exactly what the filmmakers thought was going on during certain scenes. So that's why I went through the behind the scenes on it and everything like that. But
yeah,
I don't know. It's weird. Nolan may be one of those unique directors who could just who has more power than the actual Bond producers, and he makes his own Bond. But I still think it would just end up being a Bond movie, just with a couple of flashes of Nolan in it. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah, kind of like Doctor Strange had a little bit of Raimi in there, but it was still basically just a Marvel movie.
Yeah,
you know. Okay, so Jan Demange, I'm gonna go with that name. He was one of the ones that was approached. He directed an independent film called like a foreign film called 71. I've never seen it. I've heard good stuff about
it. I have not.
He also directed White Boy Rick.
Okay,
which I'm sorry to say I have seen, and he's currently the director listed for Blade.
Okay.
Which has now been pushed back to like 2024 or something like that. David McKenzie was also approached. He directed, of course, Hell or High Water. And then Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah.
He chose to go do Dune. It looked like he actually might have had an offer, or at least they were discussing something, and then he said, well, I'm going to go do Dune. Villeneuve also, of course, directed Arrival. And, you know, many other stuff, Sicario and all that fun stuff. Danny Boyle then signs on to write and direct. We've talked about him a few times in this podcast, because I remember we actually thought he had directed one at one point, and then we were like, oh, no, he never did. I guess I just forgot Sam Mendes directed, too. I didn't realize that at the time.
Yeah.
He got hired. He also brought John Hodge along with him to write the screenplay. John Hodge had worked with him on the first few films he had done, like Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, A Life Less Ordinary. And The Beach. Boyle had directed a short film also for the 2012 Olympics, which I don't remember this, but it was titled Happy and Glorious, and Daniel Craig is in it, and he's playing Bond. And I tried to, like, I thought about looking for that and watching it, because I bet it's available, but then I kind of forgot about it. I don't know too many specifics other than what I could find, but Boyle's idea said he was going to explore Bond's origins, and it was going to take place almost solely in present-day Russia. The only thing that I could tell really made it to the final thing is that John Hodge came up with the idea of Bond having a child. Whether that's a good or bad thing that they kept that in is up to interpretation. But that was really one of the only things that really stayed in future drafts. They left in 2018, so they left well before like the delays and stuff. There was creative differences, so they rolled. Kerry Joji Fukunaga He directed, you know, he comes in and gets hired to direct. Before this, he might be most well-known, at least mainstream. He wrote, well, True Detective is a show I think he created.
Well, he was, and I don't know if he created it.
He's behind it.
He was one of the co-creators, and there was like a back and forth between he and the other. God, I gotta look this up, because the reason why he left True Detective was because he, like, they had, he had creative differences with the guy, the other guy, I believe. Nick Pizzolatto.
Yes.
So he, yeah, so he was one of the creators, and then Cary Joji Fukunaga was also a part of that. He's at least an executive producer or whatever, but I remember Fukunaga ended up leaving either because he didn't agree with what his partner was wanting to do, or it was some other reason. And that's when a lot of people pointed to True Detective losing a lot of its like goodness or whatever. So they a lot of people were attributing it to him leaving was the reason why it ended up not being so good in the next season and the following season after that. So
yeah, and then he was also a credited writer on the It films that in 2017 and 2018. So before this, he had directed a few films. They were much smaller than James Bond, though. He did Sin Nombre, was a highly acclaimed film that he did. He also did a version of Jane Eyre that gets talked about a lot from 2011.
Jane Eyre?
Jane Eyre, sorry. Mm-hmm. Good God. I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Jane Eyre. One of the first Netflix originals I remember people like, you know, it didn't get nominated for any Oscars, but it was definitely a well-regarded Beast of No Nation with Idris Elba.
Yeah.
I also think when it comes to It, like, he did not direct it. I think he was involved with that initially, though, and I think maybe he left that, too. I can't remember. But regardless, he was credited as a writer for the two films. He was also the first American director to do an Eon production Bond film.
Hmm.
And he was also the first director to receive a writing credit on any Bond film, which is that's interesting.
Yeah.
And the cast really liked working with him.
So he's the first American to get a writing credit?
No, he was the first American to direct a James Bond film that was made by Eon Productions.
Yeah, but then what was the thing after that?
It just said he was the first director of any of the films to get a co-writing.
Oh, I thought
credit.
There was something about writing, because I was like, well, Paul Haggis was was on one, I know. And
no, he's the only one that actually directed a Bond film that got a co-writing credit.
Yeah, okay, I gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. Which I still thought that was a little weird, but I also thought back about all the other directors, and most of them weren't also writers, so I guess that makes sense. I think, though, like, I think Mendez might have, like, I think there's, like, some story credits and stuff like that on some of them, because I know Mendez had some stuff that got in there, but I guess he just never actually got a writing credit.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, let's see. The cast really liked working with him. Ben Whishaw said it felt almost like an independent film because he highly encouraged improvisation while they were on set. We get a new cinematographer, Linus Sandgren, who's done a lot of work for Damon Chazelle. He won the Academy Award for La La Land.
Mm.
That was an award La La Land actually won. He's mostly known. He's considered an unconventional cinematographer. He films in a lot of different formats that don't necessarily, but a lot of people don't mess around with. Purvis and Wade, I already said, they were actually brought back again to work with Fukunaga once Danny Boyle and Hodge left. And Paul Haggis returned, but he was not credited. The most interesting person, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, comes in to do some polishing. Like I said, she's probably known to most people for Fleabag, a really popular series that ended like just a year or two ago. She got brought in 2019. She became the second female screenwriter to receive a credit on a Bond film. And the other one was all the way back, who we talked about, Joanna Hardwood from Dr. No and from Russia with Love. So they didn't have a female writer at all for however many years that is.
Yeah.
She was brought in to brush up the dialogue. I didn't find anything super specific, but the scenes that are actually funny, like the humorous dialogue and stuff, I feel like that was a lot of her doing. They also said she really beefed up, which is just kind of funny because she's still not in the movie that much. But apparently, Paloma had, or was it was it Paloma? Was that how they said her name? Paloma, the Ana de Armas character. Anyways, the Ana de Armas character.
Yeah.
Paloma. Yeah, yeah. That's right. Paloma had less to do until Phoebe Waller-Bridge came in and actually pumped her role up a little bit, beefed it up.
So, mm-hmm.
I guess she was just like, originally she was just supposed to be like, here's your suit.
Yeah,
bye.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Ana de Armas had a lot of fun working on this film, by the way. She
oh,
said,
yeah. I've seen a couple of behind the scenes on her, and she's really, yeah. really enjoyed it.
One idea that was brought up that Fukunaga toyed with, and Broccoli was like, no, we're not doing this. And I'm glad. The first two acts of the film, he suggested, we would find out it's all in Bond's head.
Oh, my God.
Blofeld has been torturing him this whole time.
Oh, God.
And then the third act would have been him realizing what's going on, and then he fights Blofeld. So I was pretty happy that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying I'm completely in love with the villain role. They ended up the thing with the villain that they ended up going with.
Yeah.
But it's still better than that, I think. An idea that Craig had started talking about in 2006 after they wrapped Casino Royale that did make the final film was, of course, Bond dying. This is the first film in the franchise where the character is exterminated. There were other ideas discussed on how he would die, including being shot, but Fukunaga felt it had to be something that wasn't just a conventional weapons death. He just thought it needed to be something a little grander and a little more meaningful, which, they pretty much nailed that, I think. They had a really hard time coming up with the title. Broccoli said she wanted a title that fit, but she felt like almost every title they were coming up with also kind of spoiled the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But they finally, in 2019, they settled on No Time to Die. Before that, it was just called Bond 25.
Yep.
I kind of wish they'd called it that. It's like the Washington football team. Bond 25. So, Cass, Daniel Craig is back. This is his fifth, and I mean, I don't know how it's not going to be his last time, but that's you know, who knows. But I'm sure it's his last time. There was a lot of talk after Spectre by Craig. Craig kind of wanted Spectre to be his last film for a minute. He actually said, I would rather slash my wrist than play Bond again. Mm-hmm. That wasn't really in reference to the films. It was just, he went through a lot. It was very physical. It was demanding. He got injured a ton. Like, yeah. I think more than, I don't remember us. If I feel like every one of his movies, we're talking about him having to have surgery or something. Which did happen in this one, by the way.
Yeah, there's absolutely no question as to why somebody would want to leave this franchise when they're doing it. It doesn't matter how successful the movies are. Your own well-being is more important than, you know, you making another $20 million paycheck or whatever they're paying for this.
Oh, yeah.
So,
exactly. I mean, it's probably like playing football or something. I mean, it's, you know, you got to think about other things. And I think also that's why, like, I know with the new one, they keep talking about they're going to cast somebody younger for the next stage. And I get that because, A, you want somebody that's willing to be, like, in five or six films. But also, you don't want them, like, they can, you know, you just do more when you're younger, right? Like, you can, you know, you don't have a lot of the issues you have once you hit, like, I don't know, late 40s, early 50s, whatever it is.
Yeah.
There was a rumor for a while, though, that they were trying to get him to do two more. And he turned down a $100 million offer. He has denied that, and he ended up getting paid $25 million for No Time to Die.
Mm.
So I'm assuming that $100 million thing was bullshit because that doesn't really make sense why he would have turned that down, but then been like, yeah, let's do 25 for one.
Yeah,
but he has also said in interviews the best part of his career is getting to play Bond. So it's not like he didn't like playing the role. It was just like I said, it was his reluctance came with all the injuries.
Yeah,
it's insane, and you know, simply just getting older.
That's why you've seen several. Yeah, you were talking about football. That's why you've seen football players suddenly. I mean, we've seen some anomalies over the years that. You know, people like Barry Sanders and Calvin Johnson and Jim Brown, all these guys retired early because of the wear
Andrew
and tear.
Locke.
Yeah, wear and tear on their bodies. And now you're seeing it happen a lot. It's like, I don't want to, I made some money. I don't need to like keep playing at this point. Just, you know, so anyway.
And I think also just, he doesn't really say this specifically, but it's probably kind of, you know, Roger Moore was like this too. I mean, you're getting older. They're having you like flirt with like these women that are like three decades younger than you. And I'm sure it gets a little weird probably.
Yeah.
After a while. Lea Seydoux is back as Dr. Madeleine Swann. This is the first female lead to be in successive Bond films. Rami Malek as...
I've always said Rami Malek on him.
Rami, it is. Okay. I don't know why I say everything wrong. I'm glad you're here. Rami Malek, Lucifer.
God, the worst name ever.
They should have just called him Lucifer.
Yeah, like, why not?
That's what you're going for.
It's like,
just
it's like almost
call
like
Lucifer.
It's almost like they did call him Lucifer, and they're like, nah, that's too dumb. Let's put a T in there and a Y.
Yeah, Lyutsifer.
So dumb.
And they end up just calling him Safin.
Yeah, exactly.
Could you imagine like having to say his first name as an actor? I'd be like, fuck you.
Yeah, right. Just call me Lucifer.
I really couldn't find stuff like other people being offered jobs or being, the only thing I saw was that like there was something about, but the villain was going to be different in the Boyle one. It was going to be a Russian. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was a Russian villain. So, but, yeah, so we got Rami Malek, Lashana Lynch,
yep.
Very, very good actress.
I love her.
Probably know her from The Woman King. She's also in Captain Marvel and Doctor Strange, mm-hmm. and Multiverse of Madness. She plays Nomi, a.k.a. the new 007.
Yep.
We're going to talk about the movie, but I still, man, that scene, because I've seen this movie like four or five times now, because we, you know, I saw it in the theater, we send it, mm-hmm. I watched it with my wife, and then I watched it again for this. And that scene where she asked Elm to give him back the 007
mm-hmm.
just makes me cringe more and more every time I see it. It's the dumbest thing.
Yeah.
They're like in the middle of this like do or die situation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, no one cared that she was 007.
No.
We were all fine with it.
It doesn't even look like Bond himself cared that she was
007. I know. anyways, Ralph Fiennes is back as Elm, who I also found out he had an injury or something right before they... I don't think it had came in the movie. I think it's during the movie, but that's why he's sitting down a lot.
Hmm.
And also why he kind of looks like he's in pain sometimes. He really was. So.
Hmm.
Hmm. He had some kind of surgery injury or something going on at the time. Ben Whishaw's back as Q. We also find out Q is gay in this film.
Yep.
And it's not really like it's not focused on. It's one line where he just says, you know, he'll be here in 20
right.
minutes or something like that.
It was a funny thing too. I noticed going back through all of these Bond movies. I remember in the Sins video. making fun of the fact that the cat that's in the house keeps appearing in places where they show up. Well,
yeah.
He says, I think two movies before that he has two cats, but the mm-hmm. way they shoot it, they don't really alert you to the fact that he's got two cats.
No.
And it just looks like a cat just shows up everywhere he goes.
I know. When they lets him in, it runs upstairs, right?
Yeah,
and then there's one on the table.
Yeah, there's one on the table that has been on the table this whole time. Yeah. But like, He says he has two cats like two movies before this. It's not like you're mm-hmm. supposed to remember that or anything.
No.
So anyway, one of those fun things when you go back over a movie you send and you go, oh yeah, he said he had two cats. Oh shit. Well, I guess that's not a sin anymore, but it's still a sin in my heart. So mm-hmm.
he's the teleporting cat.
Yeah.
That cat, I mean, maybe it's not, but like that, when I see one of those hairless cats, all I think about is Dr. Evil
mm-hmm.
or Austin Powers. That almost feels like that had to be a reference to Austin Powers. I don't know.
Bond even says they sell them, offer them with hair now or whatever.
It's... Yeah. Yeah. Or sell them with fur or something like that. That's actually a really funny scene though.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. When we got Naomi Harris is back as Moneypenny. Jeffrey Wright makes his first appearance as Felix Leiter since Quantum of Solace, which he was barely even in.
Yeah.
He's also the first actor to play Leiter three times. Billy Magnussen.
Magnussen, I think. I think it's
Magnussen.
I think it's Magnussen. There could be an extra weird syllable in there, but I think it's Magnussen.
Yeah. Billy Magnussen. It's really interesting seeing him in this because I mostly know him from Game Night.
Yeah.
Where he's a very different character.
I think around this time and around this area, he was in like, it seemed like, everything at this
point.
Yeah,
he's in a lot. Bridge of Spies, which had come out right around this time. He was also in Into the Woods. I don't remember when that came out, but it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, around this time, it wouldn't have been that long ago. He plays Logan Ash, which is Felix Leiter's partner or whatever.
Never ever trust a partner of Felix Leiter's.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in that one scene too, it's like I don't even know why Bond and Leiter don't pick up on that immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I guess they're just trying. I know Bond's trying to figure out what the hell's going on because he just saw this crazy thing happen where all of Spectre died. Yeah. Still. Christoph Waltz is back as Blofeld. He actually denied that he was coming back. And I get that maybe he thought he had to keep it secret or something. But then the trailer comes out and like it shows him in the trailer. And then he's like, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I guess I'm in it.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And Rory Kinnear is back as Tanner, our favorite.
Yes.
The only sidekick that never turns bad, although mm-hmm. he's maybe going to in one of these.
Probably.
And then Ana de Armas, we mentioned her really quick, but she is in here as Paloma. She's mm-hmm. in about 10 minutes of the movie, maybe. But
should be in more.
She makes her presence known. Huh?
Should be in more than she is.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially her and Craig have really good... they play off each other really well.
They wanted to make a Bond movie with Lashana Lynch and Ana de Armas going around kicking ass. Go. I'd watch it. Maybe not.
Oh, hell
that's
yeah.
The problem is, it seems like half the country probably wouldn't watch it, so that's why they'll never make it.
Yeah, and before the movie even came out that week, it'd be like a 2.7 on IMDb because everybody would come in and like, women!
Right, exactly, yeah.
The only other actor I'll mention, there's not a lot of actors in this movie that haven't been in other movies, other Bond movies before. So David Densick, pretty memorable role as Dr. Valdo Abruchev. But the only thing about him that I thought was kind of annoying was he was such a Boris from the character from GoldenEye.
Yeah, he was. He's exactly like that. I mean,
just needed a pen.
Yeah, yeah.
And they even have that banter like in the office or whatever that was really similar.
Right.
To,
it's like they just took the blueprint from GoldenEye and just did that little credit card, those old credit card things where you have the triplicates or whatever. They just put that in the screenplay.
That'd be amazing. Somebody needs to invent that for screenplays if it doesn't already exist. Yeah, but he's actually a really good character actor. He's in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. He was in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the David Fincher American remake. But he's the scientist who creates this thing called Project Heracles, which is I don't know if it's really a MacGuffin. I guess it is pretty important to the plot, but it's the main like weapon that that the bad guy is going to use on the world. Filming locations for this one: Jamaica, Italy, Norway, the Faroe Islands, and London. And of course, there was some stuff done at Pinewood Studios. First Bond film to have sequences shot with a 65mm IMAX camera.
Hmm.
I did not see this in IMAX, so I don't know if that was cool, but I'm sure it was. I thought that was kind of weird. This was the first one, though, but I don't know. Maybe that wasn't really the norm yet. Other than Nolan.
Yeah, you know, I mean, maybe. It's the that kind of. I guess it kind of started. Yeah, I think it's surprising. Just and it may be just the fact that Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson said, "Hey, this is the way we've always done it. Let's not try to do anything with a bigger camera or whatever." But at this point it's been a thing to shoot things in IMAX because of Nolan and Mission Impossible movies and things like that have really tried to make use of that frame. So it is kind of surprising that's the first time. So
I was so happy when I remember watching Ghost Protocol with my Fear of Heights and Vertigo. I was so happy I didn't see that in IMAX.
No, it was insane.
I would have been like passed out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That would have been awful. Or like if you're in one of those theaters where the chairs move and all that crap.
Yeah.
So Daniel Craig, I already kind of alluded to this, but he had to have surgery. He had an ankle injury while they were filming in Jamaica. So once again, he had to have surgery. I feel like we say that every week.
Yep.
Or at least something got injured.
Mm-hmm.
They also damaged the 007 stage at Pinewood. There was a controlled explosion that went a little haywire, and that delayed filming even more.
Hmm.
And then obviously we already talked about the film had a lot of delays with Boyle. Obviously COVID delayed it after it was done, but while it was being filmed, like there was at one point, this should have come out before COVID anyways.
Mm-hmm.
This was supposed to come out in 2019. So, they just got really screwed. There's supposed to be a lot of callbacks to past Ken Adams sets in this movie, mostly including Safin's lair. There's supposed to be a direct reference to Dr. No in there. I could not find what it was.
Yeah.
Did you notice anything?
I didn't really notice, but it's also now been nearly a year since I've seen Dr. No.
Yeah.
So,
but I was, it was weird. I couldn't find anybody that actually said what it was. It was just the director or somebody said that.
Mm-hmm.
But the article I was reading just didn't say what it was. The stunt coordinator, who was Lee Morrison, he said the motorcycle stunt was the hardest one to shoot. And he said it was mainly because the roads in Matera, Italy, where they were shooting, were all cobblestone.
Mm.
So it was super slippery and it was super bumpy.
Mm.
So it ended up really, it took them forever to be able to get that down. There are a lot of long takes in this film. That was something that Fukunaga wanted. Daniel Craig really didn't want it. I don't know if it just makes the action scenes easier to shoot if you're doing like close-ups and cutting, probably. I'm sure that's what it was. But Craig wanted it to be more traditionally cut. But then once he saw what Fukunaga was doing, he became a fan. A lot of the sound design is based around video games. Fukunaga saw it's Call of Duty. There's like this metallic clink sound that they paid homage to it or they took it from it. I don't know. Also said Half-Life, Biohazard, and The Last of Us were also big influences.
Yeah,
I've never
really
played any of these games, so
yeah. See, I guess that makes sense here and there.
Well, it was interesting to me because I felt like, especially towards the end, a lot of this felt sometimes like a video game, especially at the end where he's like going upstairs and he keeps having to shoot people, and
mm-hmm.
There's like grenades being dropped down.
Right,
all that kind
there,
of stuff.
There, that was some, it's funny. Some of that. I thought about that a little bit. I was wondering if The Last of Us had any kind of influence at all in this on this movie.
Oh, that's interesting.
But, I mean, it was just a brief. There was just brief moments.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, this is so The Last of Us or anything, you know. So.
No, I know. Mm-hmm. But that was definitely like, that was him going up different levels and there were different bad guys or shooters or whatever. I mean, it was hard to not mistake that as something that was clearly supposed to be kind of have that style to it.
So let me go on Screen Rant. They do a whole thing about Dr. No. They say Safin parallels Dr. No. The two Bond villains.
There were a lot of rumors that that's who he was.
The two Bond villains bear so many similarities that it's theorized that Safin might actually be Dr. No, although this ended up not being the case. Let's see. It's plenty of Easter eggs. Safin even donning a Japanese no mask when he appears. The two Bond villains have strikingly similar lairs. The company they keep, and even them both seemingly having their hearts on the right side rather than the left. I don't know about that. I don't remember anything about Safin's heart in this. However, while Dr. No introduces James Bond to the organization Spectre, Safin poses a much more personal threat to James Bond. And then let's see, they visit Jamaica is another one is kind of, man, it's kind of silly. And then James Bond meets Felix Leiter in Jamaica. That's the other one. And then let's see, Nomi's introduction references Honey Ryder in Dr. No. It's like stuff like that. It looks like they're, in a way, they're stretching it a bit. Like I can understand like the character himself being like kind of like a Dr. No, but like everything else they're coming up with in that article looks like, I guess. Okay.
I get. Yeah. Both movies had Ocean.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I forgot to write that down, but I did read this. Safin was actually supposed to have a sidekick. Like there was supposed to be like an odd job or like a, you know, like Dave Bautista in the last film.
Mm-hmm.
But that that character did not make it. To the final drafts, it got pushed out at some point. Also, for this movie being like as long as it is, like Safin is not in it at all. Like he's so barely in it. I forget that every time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's like a good 45 minutes where you don't see him at all. I think. Even though like we just talked about De Armas, even though she was only on screen for like 10 minutes. She had to go through a lot of rigorous training just for that and all the stunt work because that was a pretty big action sequence. And she loved it. She said it was a lot of fun.
She's
it was
a
the hardest
badass.
She's ever worked. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She said it was a lot of fun. I kind of feel like, just seeing her in interviews about it, I kind of feel like the way her character is acting, like this is my first assignment and stuff like that, like I almost feel like that's her, like being just, like I'm in a scene with Daniel Craig talking about Bond.
Yeah.
It's also funny, obviously, because they were in Knives Out together, too. I also feel like Knives Out helped them feel more comfortable, letting Daniel Craig actually be funny, because like I feel like that made, I didn't read this, like I'm just saying this, but it was interesting after Knives Out, all of a sudden he's getting like these genuinely funny dialogue in this Bond movie.
Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, obviously, as well. But I just wonder if they felt more comfortable. They thought Craig
might be,
Yeah. Yeah. Because my favorite is Lea Seydoux, after he's met her kid, and then she's like, come downstairs, I've got something I've got to show you. And then he's just like, is it another kid?
Yeah, it's another kid. Yeah.
Music. So Dan Romer was initially signed on to be the composer. He had worked with Fukunaga on Beast of No Nation. He also worked on the HBO miniseries Station 11, and he won an Emmy for that.
Mm-hmm.
Or was nominated for an Emmy. Sorry, he did not win it. Romer left, though, over creative differences. He leaves in 2019, and Hans Zimmer, who I would think most people know who that is, but yep. Lion King, Pirates of the Caribbean, Inception.
Million
all
others.
All the Dark Knight movies.
Mm-hmm.
He's a big deal.
Yeah, yes, he is.
He was brought up. He was brought on to replace them. It was the first time that a composer had been replaced in post-production on a Bond film.
Hmm.
And then for the song, No Time to Die, this is only the second Craig film to actually, of course, the other titles don't really lean themselves to song titles. So Skyfall and this one were about all they could get away with. Billie Eilish and her brother, Finneas O'Connell, they co-wrote the theme song. Billie Eilish obviously performs it. She was the youngest singer to write a Bond theme song, and she was 18 at the time
when
this was done. Also, what's interesting is because the song was released right before one of the times the movie was supposed to come out, and then the movie got delayed. So the song ends up winning a Grammy for its, like, I didn't even know this Grammy existed, but it's best song written for visual media, but it won it 6 months before the movie was even released.
Mm-hmm.
So this song had been playing for like a year. Once the movie got released, Louis Armstrong's version of We All Have the Time in the World is also used in part of the film's score.
Mm-hmm.
It's also played over the closing credits. And this was a version also used in Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which was a film that Fukunaga felt paralleled in some ways with Bond dealing with the loss. It was a different type, but it was, you know, Bond dealing with the loss of a loved one.
I believe it's Lazenby that says we have all the time in the world at the end of Honor Majesty's Secret Service, and of course Diana Rigg gets blown away at the end of it, and he's sad, and then George Lazenby never played James Bond again.
Because of that
Let's just everybody can connect the dots.
Yeah, it's just like we discovered Spectre was a remake of Scream 3.
Right, and, exactly. You know, nobody
you
else
can't
did.
Say it wasn't.
Right.
Come on here, Barbara Broccoli. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Tell
me, just fess up. Fess up.
So yeah, so it's like the opposite, basically. It's Bond dying and what's her name? What's it? Madeline
Swan.
Yeah, Madeline Swan. Also, this I think we've talked about this the last couple movies, but this was Billie Eilish. The song won the Grammy. I mean, the Oscar for best, you know, song in a movie. And it was the third one to ever win, but it was also the third in a row.
Yep.
So, and as of now, the last one to win. So I guess we'll have to see if they can keep that streak alive with the next one, where I guess it'll be sung by, I don't know, Nicki Minaj.
When they officially do hire Harry Styles as James Bond.
Yeah.
They can just use him to do the original song.
Oh, that'd be weird.
Well.
That'd be wild.
Yeah.
You kind of have to.
Big Willie style in there with Harry Styles. There you go.
I think you kind of have to make him sing the song if he's in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Then you'd have Harry Styles singing over Harry Styles. That'd be wild.
Mm-hmm.
Reception of this movie, it had at the time an approval rating of 83% on Rotten Tomatoes, average rating of 7.3 out of 10. So it was pretty positive overall. Positives were mostly the handling of Bond's departure during the Craig era. Everybody thought it was a nice send-off. It was considered one of the better send-offs for an actor playing the role, which isn't that... I mean, It almost has to be by default.
I mean, every single other one of them have been, well, he might come back, and they don't have a real send-off. And in this one, they knew he was not going to do another one, and they went ahead and killed him off at the end, because that's what you can do.
I have no idea why they thought or wanted Roger Moore to come back after You Don't Kill Him.
I don't know.
I mean, Kevin Mayer of the New York Times, he even put it in his year-end top 10 best film list. Stunt and action sequences, those were also praised by a bunch of people. Negatives were mostly surrounding the length of the film. This was
once again
162 minutes.
Yeah, it's nearly 3 hours. And again, I don't think it needs to be. There's parts that could be cut easily. It's not, this is whenever you say a movie is too long, it's not because, oh, I think movies that are 2.5 hours are too long. It's that you see places where they just, for whatever reason, they could not take it upon themselves to cut certain things out of the movie, and it just ends up being a lot of bloat at the end. So
yeah, MCU movies are probably the worst about this, because I mean, there's like so many scenes and you're just like, do we really need the Guardians of the Galaxy arguing in a car? Like, is that advancing the story in any way?
Yeah.
But yeah, like the middle of this movie, the middle section of this movie is like 45 minutes of exposition. It's the craziest thing. Like, it's just, and like I said, you don't even see Safin, and it's just them going around trying to figure out things. And it's, God, it's just, they go see Blofeld.
I mean, yeah.
It's not that interesting. I think when you say a movie's too long, it's because it feels long, right? Because there are, I mean, Lawrence of Arabia is what, almost 4 hours? That movie doesn't feel like
doesn't
that,
feel like it's yeah, it really does feel like it's a, you know, if you ever look at the time of Lawrence of Arabia, when it starts feeling long, it's almost over.
So yeah, and Rami Malek's was criticized a little bit. Like, I didn't see a ton, but nobody really said anything positive about him either. So he just kind of was, he was,
well,
just kind of,
and
there.
Again, I don't think that's his fault. I don't think
I don't either.
I don't think that's a problem with him. I think from the moment from the moment they decided the direction of this movie, his character was doomed in my eyes. So and that may that may not be the same take everybody else has about it, but I do feel like as soon as they made the plot what it was, then his character was kind of doomed. So
yeah, for sure, I'm with you on that. It won the Best Original Song, as we already said. It also received nominations for Best Sound and Best Visual Effects. I don't know. The visual effects sometimes, I don't know all the time what they're nominating when they nominate stuff for visual effects. So, because I don't know what in this, like, I mean, it looked good visually, but like, I don't know. Like, I just, I don't know.
Yeah.
But there weren't that many movies released that year either, so maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe something only visual effects people can see. Although it's funny, we say that, and then, you know, remember Bohemian Rhapsody won the editing Oscar, and there's like a 30-minute video on YouTube. I wish I could remember the guy's name that did it so that I could direct everybody towards it. But it shows how terrible that editing is, and it won an Oscar. So, like, who knows what's going on there? There's probably a lot of, like, buddy-buddy stuff going on when people get visual effects nominations and other kinds of nominations.
I mean, Suicide Squad won an Academy Award. So.
It did. It really did.
I think that was makeup, though. I think that's what that was.
It did.
But I just love saying that. Oscar winner, Suicide Squad.
Oh, yeah.
That never gets old. All right. So I guess now we can go talk about the film, which we've given up probably a little bit. But I don't know. This is an interesting movie. So we'll go to the next segment. It is called A Review to a Kill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I've got you in my sights.
Get the fuck out of my sight before I demolish you.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
There's no need to shout. I'm not shouting.
Why don't you stop your whining and get on with it? I've heard this shit before.
We are going to give you our thoughts on whatever film we are discussing this week. This week we are discussing No Time to Die. I have not said Die Another Day once, except for when I've said I haven't said Die Another Day.
Yes. That's
pretty good. I don't know why. I just keep wanting to call it that.
Yeah,
what do you think of No Time to Die, all 163 minutes of it?
Yeah, I was sort of alluding to the fact that I don't like the direction of this. Everything about the movie so far have made the villain important to Bond in some way that that is apparent from the beginning. And the only reason why Safin becomes a personal vendetta is because he kidnaps Bond's family. I understand that. Like, that's definitely a thing that, you know, that, but he's got no importance really to Bond himself until that happens. And so, you know, Madeline makes reference of this in the last movie, that a man came to kill her dad, and found her mom instead. Of course, her mom throws out that little line before she dies, where it's like, "Oh, your father is an assassin. You love killers," and that's the thing that. Oh, okay, so she falls in love with Bond later. That's supposed to be like, okay, cool. But the fact that he's just not he's connected because Spectre killed his family. And I like the idea of Spectre creating other monsters that are not connected to Spectre. I like that a lot. I just kind of wish that he had more connection to Bond himself before the movie even starts. Like maybe
what's the last film too, right? So you kind of want that to be, you know,
like it could have been Bond killed his family because his family was in the line of fire of somebody that Bond killed, or it could have been a number of things, but it ends up being where this, you know, where he's, it's like, he's just kind of an unknown in this. And it's, and I feel like they're, I don't know. It just, I never connected to him as a villain in this movie, the way all the other Bonds are. So there's a continuity that of course they've already screwed up several times because they're calling Spectre Quantum there for a second. You know, there's a continuity there that I felt left me a little cold. It's hard to sometimes follow who's what, who's doing what, because Lucifer Safin and Blofeld are both coordinating things in all of this. And I think the only time someone is working I think the scientist is working for Lucifer, because he changes all the DNA in that that capsule that they shoot off in the party, the birthday party. So it kills all the Spectre people in there, and then I think that assassin Primo is working with Blofeld, and then he's working with Lucifer by the end of it. So he switches sides, but there's so many things in this. I remember sending a lot of the stuff that's in this movie when we did the video for it, and it's just like, the mechanical eye that Blofeld is using to communicate. They're just like, oh yeah, he had a mechanical eye that we somehow never saw when I guess we just let him have the eye patch or something, like when he went in. It's not like these mechanical eyes are hard to spot. You can see Primo at the beginning of it. He has one of those eyes, and it's easy to spot. It's not like, oh man, that looks so real, you know? And so, like, he's apparently been able to, like, communicate to his underlings this whole time using this mechanical eye, and nobody picked up on it. The fact that Madeline Swan is his only trusted psychiatrist, and that they let that they allowed that to happen, just made no sense to me. And they need it so that Lucifer can go in and say, "Hey, put this poison on Blofeld." So, you know, so that she's the, you know, they make it so that not only she has to be involved with the big Blofeld meeting, Bond is also involved with it, and that's the way they connect back after all those years. When they go and talk to Blofeld, Blofeld's like, I didn't have any real plan, but I knew you were going to go and visit Vesper's grave at one point. So I guess he's got people just waiting.
I guess. I think we said that, too.
Yeah, we did. And it's just like there's people just waiting for him to walk by the grave. And, of course, the whole thing makes him distrust Madeline. And Madeline is about to tell him, like, I've got something you need to know. And he's like, I bet you do. And that's that. That's it. We don't really hear anything about what secret kept her from. Like, it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that Spectre shows up to kill him at all. Doesn't have anything to do with that. So you're sitting there like Bond. You're like, oh, Madeline, like, did just like what Vesper did, and she threw him under the bus and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But then when they reveal that she didn't, Do you remember what the secret is that she was going to tell him that?
Madeline was going to tell him?
Yeah.
Yeah, because at first I thought she was going to tell him that she was Blofeld's daughter, but then I got the impression she didn't know that for a minute.
Well, she's Mr. White's
not Blofeld. It's his, what was she going to tell him then? No, I don't know. Because she never says what that secret is.
I don't think she ever says what the secret is. Mr. White is, it's like he knows all the things that she's told him. The only thing that she may have not told him in that story about the man who came to shoot her is that he survived and he saved her, but I don't think that has anything to do with the Vesper grave whatsoever. They make it out to be like, oh, Madeline's another Vesper Lynn. She's just out for herself and blah, blah, blah. And then finally when it's revealed she didn't do anything, it's like, well, what was all that before then where she was like, I got to tell you something and whatever. So maybe I'm missing something. I completely understand that there's some times where something important may have just slipped through the cracks. But I didn't like that whatsoever, that they were just there camped out waiting for him to show up and visit the grave. And of course it's so dumb too, the way he goes there and he just notices something in the ground and it's Spectre's like symbol on a card and like the bomb should have easily killed him. Going through all of this, I'm just not happy with this story whatsoever. It leaves me cold. I know 7.3, I guess people are liking the fact that this is how Bond ends. Oh, and he found love in the end, and he has a child and all this, and maybe that's what people are really responding to by the end of this movie, but the effort to get there, I don't think is worth it. I just didn't enjoy this movie. So
yeah, I like it more than you. I don't disagree with a lot of the things you're saying. And by the way, people, like, I was just doing a Google search, because the only thing people think it might have been was she might have been telling him she was pregnant.
Has a kid, but that doesn't have anything to do. Well, she's pregnant. Yeah. That doesn't have anything to do with Blofeld either. That doesn't.
No, it absolutely. No, I think it was probably something that they put in and then they just, it almost feels like they edited something out and then just left that in. I don't know.
Yeah. It's really strange, that whole thing, because you're like, oh, she's got a secret. Oh, they're going to find out that. Okay, she did throw him under the bus, but it was for the right reasons or some shit like that.
Yeah.
And like, you know, she's really innocent and all this. But it turns out she's completely 100% innocent. Yeah.
Yeah, she just happened to take him there because she thought that would help him.
Yeah.
You know, it would help him. It would help him say bye to her, and then, you know, they could go off and have their kid and have fun.
Yeah.
Because Bond is also retired again.
Yeah.
At the beginning of this movie. I feel like there's less time that Bond actually works for MI6 in the Craig films than he's not.
The other thing.
Probably not.
The other thing, too, we briefly mentioned this, although I think I confused it. Like, we're talking about the micro blood, which they do use again in this one to track Bond and the new 007. They use the micro blood, but they're using a nanobot technology to spread this virus that attacks DNA. So basically that's the reason why he sacrifices himself at the end, is because he knows that he'll give it to his daughter if he makes it off the island. The thing is, they make this whole thing where it's like, oh, it's in your blood forever and there's no cure for it. And I was like, yeah, but couldn't you get off the island and just not see your family for a while and
wear
see if
gloves.
And see if there's a way that maybe, you know, yeah, or be in a plastic bubble. I don't know there, but, but like, it seems like to me, this is a brand new technology that they're learning a whole bunch about. And I guarantee you, if they wanted to keep Bond around, they wanted to keep Daniel Craig around or whatever, or he wanted to stay around, they would have found a serum that would have affected it. They would have found.
Oh, absolutely.
So like, it's weird to me that he's just like, oh, well, I guess that's it for me. I guess I'm just going to let these bombs rain down on me at the end of the movie instead of like hoping for maybe a cure or whatever. They're just saying outright, there's no cure for this, and almost like there never will be. And it's like, come on now.
Is Q a doctor? Like,
yeah, I don't know. He's like a hacker, and he's a gadget inventor, and he's a doctor. Yes,
he's just like, and he can make really elaborate dinners.
Yes,
I don't even know if we said that in this video. I was just thinking that this time, like, I don't know how Q would have the knowledge to give like that kind. Like you said, A, they don't know much about this,
mm-hmm.
but also I just don't know why he would have the medical knowledge to be able to say. I feel like, yeah, you'd send him to like the top geneticist or whatever they think they need to send him to.
And these nanobots are obviously spreading to other people. So do they reproduce inside?
I don't know. It's
like,
not explained well.
Like nanobots themselves sound like a finite thing. They don't sound like things that go in and reproduce and have extra ones that come out. So like, it's one of those things that I'm just like, in theory, I like the setup of that because he makes the sacrifice and whatever, but I feel like they needed to explain that a little bit better for that to be a true ending that I really like. Because it just seems like he's just giving up. He's just like, I'm done, you know? So.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I mean, I like the ending, but I also, I don't disagree with that at all. I don't know if it completely earns the ending, I guess, is what we're trying to say. By the way, and I think you might have even corrected me, but I obviously meant Mr. White was her dad and not Blofeld. But I was just going to say Bond already knew that, so that could be a secret.
He knows that very early on in Spectre.
Yeah. I will say, like, so this kind of feels like Live and Let Die to me, where we talked about, I remember when Live and Let Die, we were talking about, or at least I was saying, I thought this is a really good Bond movie for like 45 minutes to an hour. Mm-hmm. And then once you kind of realize what the villain's doing and all that stuff, it just kind of, I don't know, it starts going downhill.
That's the ultimate thing there too. The villain plan, which reminds me, I can't remember which villain this reminds me of, but like at first, he's just trying to get revenge on Spectre, and you're like, oh well, that's good enough, that's perfectly fine. But he can't just be getting revenge on Spectre. He also has to be somehow wanting to destroy the world too at the same time. And
well, he wants to sell it, because he does say at one point, he says the buyers are like at one point when they're on the island, he says the buyers will be here shortly. So he wants to show how it works and I think sell it to the highest bidder.
Yeah.
That was the impression I got.
And it's just, and to me, if you're motivated by the family that got killed by Spectre, you're not also looking to be like spread more evil around the world after that. But you know, they have to make him a Bond villain somehow, a classic Bond villain.
Well, and that's still confusing, though, because like I said, I just happened to catch that line of dialogue. Like, I don't think there's a scene where he actually says that, but the fact that he says the buyers will be here shortly,
mm-hmm.
I assume that's what he's talking about. And the other thing is, like, Tanner is telling Elm that, like, or Mallory, as he's mostly called in this. I love Craig saying Mallory, by the way. Mm-hmm. What have you done, Mallory?
Mm-hmm.
And I love they tied him into this, too. And they did make it seem like maybe Elm was a villain. Then you find out that, like, why they were building it was a good thing, but then mm-hmm. you know but then obviously it was one of the things that could turn badly quickly. But although I still don't really know how you could use this for the good of anything, but whatever. But they start saying like all these other, like there's these ships coming in and all that stuff, so I got confused as to whether that was the buyers, because they don't mention them again. I mean, so
yeah, there were apparently Russian boats military. Coming in, and yeah, there's like Russian boats coming in and all that, and they're coming to get Heracles, but yeah, there's not really any like discussion as to the, we don't, like a past Bonds, you'd always see like a big meeting with, you know, like in Goldfinger, you'd see all the potential buyers would come in and,
yeah,
you know, and then he'd kill whoever didn't want to do it and, you know, that type of thing.
I was just thinking about those gangsters in Goldfinger, like, hey,
yeah.
What are you trying to sell me? What are you doing here? And they're clearly like French people or something, French actors.
Right.
Yeah, so it gets really convoluted and confusing there at the end. There's a lot of stuff going on, and I don't think it feels like they edited some stuff out or they didn't. I don't know. There's something going on at the end that doesn't make a lot of sense. A big thing early on, though, that bothers me a little bit is they went out of their they just went all the way around to try to get this continuity correct in Spectre, where they're bringing Spectre in, and we're going to forget that quantum stuff, and we're going to make the villain in Skyfall is even going to be part of Spectre.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kill them all.
Yeah.
Like 30 minutes into this movie. Or like an hour into this movie. All that time
spent getting Spectre back, and then you just wipe them out in two movies. It's kind of like the White Walkers in Game of Thrones, where they sat there for like seasons going, how dangerous these guys are, and kill them in one episode.
Yeah. And I feel like in some ways I like this movie more the more I watch it, but then in other ways there are things that I keep noticing that kind of take me back out of it. I don't even understand why Safin wants that kid.
Yeah.
I cannot, like, for the life of me.
No.
I guess I get why he kidnaps them. But even that I don't really understand because she didn't do anything to him.
He kidnaps the kid and then like she's like, I don't want to go, and he's like, okay.
Yeah.
He just lets her go.
Yeah, he was like, I don't care anymore. Like, go off and you're gonna go find your doo-doo and you're gonna get
you're gonna get
blown up. The kid's adorable, though. I love that kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even mind that. I don't mind that Bond has a kid. I mean, it definitely makes the ending hit a little harder. But at the same time, she doesn't really know him. The kid doesn't, I mean. So
yeah.
I guess it's more sad for Swan. But yeah, I don't know. There is a lot of stuff in this. It looks amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is some of the best stunt work and action sequences I've seen in any of the Craig films. I love that. The scene at the Spectre party is a lot of fun to watch with Ana de Armas and Bond, like, you know, going around and taking out people. And there's also that great sequence at the beginning that they apparently had a really hard time with, but I love the motorcycle chase.
Yeah, and there's a pretty cool unbroken shot going through a stairway towards the end. That's really nice. And
yeah, the thing I was saying kind of felt like a video game, but yeah.
Yeah,
no,
one of those things that they're talking about in the action, like the 6-minute action thing that I saw on this, is that this is going to be Bond, like Daniel Craig's last big action scene.
Yeah.
We want to make it good. So that's what they did with that one. It reminded me a bit of the Atomic Blonde one. They did that same thing in Atomic Blonde, and similar setting almost. Maybe not a factory, but a staircase and all that, where they did that unbroken shot.
That's, it's been a minute, but that sounds right. That movie has really grown on me.
Yeah.
So all that's fun.
Well, Children of Men too. Children of Men also has a pretty similar scene as well, in a broken shot that goes through stairways and stuff like that. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. And then obviously, like we said, we like Lashana Lynch. We like Ana de Armas. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of fun actors. And I even like the guy playing Urobichev. It's just that he's such a Boris. It's kind of hard to.
Yeah.
I do wonder things, though, like in the action scene in the stairways, though, and it's a great moment when he throws the one grenade down and then Bond throws it back up, and then all of a sudden, like, 5 or 6 come down. But I'm sitting there thinking, why did you start with 5 or 6? Like, why would you?
I know.
Because it's like the villain's like, it's funnier if I do it this way.
Right, exactly.
Bond also surviving a lot of these things, even before he dies, it seems to be getting more ridiculous. You talking about the opening sequence, though, I will say Craig films have been the most consistent with the opening sequences, I think. I think all of them have been pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-title sequences.
This one is good. It just makes no sense to me.
No, it doesn't.
Just the whole Blofeld, like, is just apparently got henchmen hanging out by a Vesper's grave waiting for Bond.
Yeah,
to,
that doesn't
you
make
know.
Any sense.
Yeah.
No, I 100% agree with that. But, I mean, the action sequence itself
action
is
good.
Really well done. Yeah.
And he's got the bulletproof car, which just seems to never ever break, no matter how many bullets get shot into it, and nobody ever shoots the tires, and
like, that doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't you do that first?
Yeah. Like, just make sure he can't drive off.
I do like that moment, though, where he's just, like, being a dick. Mm-hmm. Like, just, like, staying there.
Yeah.
I think it's just, like, that thing he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Like, he wants to help her, but he's also super pissed at her. So, mm-hmm. just kind of... I can't imagine I'll ever be in that situation.
Nope.
I don't see my wife ratting me out to, like, you know, international bad guys.
Yeah.
You never know.
You never know.
But yeah. And then, like I said, I think there's a lot of good humor in this movie. I think this one is, like, genuinely funny. Like, it's not just, like, the cheesy shit, you know, Bond saying these stupid one-liners and stuff. Like, there's actual humorous moments that kind of take you out of, like, you know, alleviate you, I guess, from all the direness that's going on. So I think it's structured really interestingly. I just, at the end of the day, though, I don't think Rami Malek's character is that and maybe it's not his fault. I can't say I'm a huge fan of him. I don't think he's terrible by any means, but I'm just, I don't know. What I've seen him in, I've never just been, woo.
Yeah.
It could just be the quality of the movies, too. I never got into Mr. Robot, so I don't, maybe that's where I would be like, hell yeah. But I just never got into that. So I don't know, but I don't like the villain at all. I don't. He's one of the least interesting villains, I think, in the entire franchise.
Yeah.
And you don't, like I said, you don't even notice, like, he's gone for as long as he's gone, and then he shows back up, and you're like, oh yeah, fuck, this guy's here.
Yeah.
And like you said, the ending just doesn't make sense. I feel like this should lead up to him killing Spectre almost. Like it just. Like, after he's done that, I don't know. It's not that interesting. If that's all he wants to do is sell it, like, that's not interesting. Like, there's nothing about that that's interesting. And I still can't really figure out why he decided to, I guess he's just crazy. So maybe that's why he decided to kidnap Swan and her daughter. But I still don't.
Well, and it's like a thing he says when he goes into her office that, you know, once you save a life, you're connected. It's just the same as ending a life and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, all right, I guess. You know, that's the one thread of the connection that they're talking about, and that he's actually in love with her, I guess, and whatever. That's why he goes through that whole thing where he mentions all the different similarities he has with Bond. You know, it's like, you know, like License to Kill and in love with Madeleine Swan and blah, blah, blah. And like, it's like, yeah, I do remember you had that License to Kill. I forgot about that.
And you could even, I think you could even argue that Bond is not needed. Like, I cannot figure out for the life of me why Ash thinks it's a good idea to hire him.
Yeah.
Because he has to know that if he did find this out, I don't know. That just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me when you find out that he's bad. And I don't know why M brings him back in. He even basically even after Bond, like, you know, helps them. You know, M's just like, fuck you, basically. Thank you for your service again.
Yeah.
And I really like Ralph Fiennes in this movie, though. I hate that he was injured, but I do something about his performance. He does. It feels like he's got a lot more to do, I guess. You know, he's involved in it to a point and all that kind of stuff. This might be the best Craig is. It's up there. I mean, it's in that Casino Royale, Skyfall, as far as his performance. He's got a lot of weight. He's got a lot of gravitas, he does very well. Whether that ending scene makes sense or not, or whether it's earned, he does very well in that moment. And it's kind of sad, you know, when he's like climbing up that ladder trying to talk to Madeline and all that stuff. It just sucks. I'm still curious as fuck what they're gonna do, though. Like, that's the thing about this that interests me even more. It's like, what's next? Like,
I
don't know if they're going to go back at the beginning. I hope not. I don't want to see a fucking origin story.
Where they just do a Dr. No and it's a remake.
He gets bit by a spider.
Right.
I don't want to see that again.
Absolutely. Yep.
Hey, MCU figured it out with Spider-Man. They were able to introduce him like he had already been. I mean, they can throw Bond in something. I mean, I guess he's going to be earlier in his career. It's going to have to be.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm really curious. Or maybe there'll be multiverses. Maybe that's what they're going to do.
Maybe.
Yeah, so I don't know. Overall, I do think I like this movie, though, because there's just so much to like, but it definitely falls far from being like a great Bond film, which sucks, because I think with a little bit more of an interesting villain, because I think the device, the weapon, is interesting enough, even though some of it doesn't make sense. But I think that's an interesting enough a thing to have in there, but I just wish you had a more interesting bad guy.
Yeah.
And like you said, someone that tied into Bond a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Or it, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I feel like they've done this it's personal thing with Bond way too many times too, so that doesn't really work.
Yeah. You know, there's I know what you mean.
We're now going to rank this film in four different categories. Our scale will be based on something that Bond holds near and dear to his heart, as long as they are shaken and not stirred, and that would be martinis. So for each category, we will rank from 1 to 5 martinis, 5 being the best damn liquid that has ever passed your lips, 1 being the whale liquor you had to settle for or were too drunk to care that night. So the first thing we always rank is the story, which pretty much is our overall feeling, like what we've been talking about, I guess. Our overall feeling.
Yeah, I mean, bagged on this movie a bunch. There are a lot of ideas I like in the movie. I just don't think they need to all be in the same movie. I'm going to give this a 3 just because I just think it's good, and then they just execute everything poorly for me. So yeah. It can't be a 2.5. It's very close to dropping to a 2.5 for me, but I'm going to go and just make it a solid 3.
Yeah, I don't think this is anywhere close to as good as Casino Royale or Skyfall. I think it is quite a bit better than Spectre and Quantum of Solace, and for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You could argue that both of those tell at least Quantum of Solace, you could argue it might tell its story a little better.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the quality of the film, I think this is better. But I'm still somewhere around there. I might be a little closer to 3.5, but yeah, 3 for me. The Bond, the performance, I think Craig's great here. I don't know. I can't remember what I've given in the past, but I 4.5, I guess.
Yeah.
I'll give him
a 4. He's always good. He's always good as this character. So.
Now this the villain, which really all we have is Safin. I guess you can count Ash, but I don't really want to.
That Primo guy who shows up with the mechanical
eye.
Yeah, Primo. But this is a 2 for me. I don't pretend to know exactly how they could have made this character better, but it just feels like he comes out of nowhere in the final chapter of a Bond that you are making Daniel Craig's send off. It would have been nice for this villain to have more of a connection to Bond himself before he kidnaps the family. And that's what's sort of weird to me about this is a big, huge, you know, we're sending you off, Daniel Craig. Thank you for your service. And now we're going to introduce this villain that your girlfriend ran into a few years ago. he's a 2 for me. I don't understand his motivations, where he kills Spectre and then he still wants to do sort of a global domination thing by the end of it. So I'm not a big fan of it.
No, I'm saying it's a 2. He's not very threatening. Like I don't ever feel like he could even hang. I mean, there's like one little kind of fight scene with the two of them, but Bond's mostly dominating it. You know, he throws them in the water and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The only thing that happens there is I guess Safin's able to scratch his face.
Yeah.
With the convenience blood or whatever you call that. The Bond song, No Time to Die. I really like this song. I think I mentioned this last week, not a huge Billie Eilish fan. Not that I don't think she's talented, I do, but that's just not the style of music I really listen to. But this is obviously done in a Bond style. Mm-hmm. But she's also able to kind of add her attitude, her flourish to it. So I think it works really well. I'm going to give it a 4. I think the only one that I might like better is Skyfall.
Yeah.
So,
I'm going to give this one a 5. I really, really love the, Billie Eilish, and I love what she does with this song too. When I first heard that she was doing a Bond song, I was like, I don't know about that, but yeah, it turns out really, really good.
Yeah.
So
I will say I've only heard like her radio stuff. I need to like actually like pop up because she's always intrigues me, but I've just never really been able to get into her. But I do think she's very talented, obviously.
Yep.
I get why people like her, but maybe if I just like actually listen to an album, if people still do that these days, maybe I'd find some stuff. Maybe it would make more sense.
I'm not sure. If you don't like the stuff that's on the radio, I don't know if you would like. I would hear a bunch of stuff on Alt Nation, and I don't know how much you would hear outside of straight pop radio, or if you ever have satellite radio and you listen to Alt Nation or anything. So if you didn't like any of the things that you heard on Alt Nation, you may not like anything that she comes out with.
Yeah. I don't know if dislike's the word, but she hasn't really like I don't know. It's just not something I'm like, oh, I want to listen to that right now.
Yeah.
I mean, the songs are perfectly fine. I don't think they're bad songs. It's just something, I don't know. She's just got it. And she has a very unique style. I mean, there is something, she's almost like, it almost kind of reminds me, I mean, it's very different style, but in that, and she's kind of like a Bob Dylan, where I just like, I don't think there's anyone that sounds like her. Just like, I don't think there's anyone that sounds like Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And so I like that because I think that's cool. But obviously, you know, still, if you don't have an ear for it, you don't have an ear for it. So it is what it is. But I can still respect her.
Yep.
So, yeah. So, obviously, we're not doing Spy Who Reads Me because this is not based on a book. Because if it had, it might have made more sense. I don't know. But we are going to do something a little fun. We're going to do, now that we've covered all 27 of these films, we're going to kind of quickly, or as quickly as we can, we have each ranked them. I don't know. I guess we'll just figure out what our individual rankings are. I'm just kind of curious how close they are. So do you want to start at the bottom?
Yeah, I'll start at the bottom and work my way. Now, I will say, let's say, I'm going to give them groupings, and I will make a definitive, like, whether or not you'll see how I'm doing this. I have ranked it in a definitive way, but I could see a lot of these, like, sliding up and down depending on several factors or whatever, but... The first group of movies, I actually went back and listened to what I gave each thing. I couldn't find all of them. Like, you trying to scrub through your own audio on a thing is hard to find a lot of things, but I found a lot of them. But 27 is going to be The Man with the Golden Gun. I think I've been pretty clear that that's the worst one since I think the beginning.
I'll go ahead and say that's mine too.
Yeah, so that's
pretty easy.
That one is had a one. I think it's the only one that I gave a one out of all of them. The rest of them in this grouping, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all have twos or 2.5s. So... Mm-hmm. A View to a Kill is 26.
Oh, that's mine too.
Okay, good.
That's gonna be interesting.
25 is the 1967 Casino Royale.
Okay.
24 is For Your Eyes Only.
Interesting.
Yep.
Oh wow. Go
23
ahead.
Is Die Another Day. 22 is Diamonds Are Forever. 21 is The World Is Not Enough. And 20 is You Only Live Twice.
All right.
I could see flip-flopping several of these back and forth, but they're all the ones that really just come off like not the best, you know, not even average Bond at sometimes. So
yeah, I'll go ahead and do. So you did 27 through 20. Is that what you did?
Yep.
Yeah. So mine was Man with the Golden Gun and View to a Kill. Those are the same. I had Diamonds Are Forever at 25, but that's still not far. And then I'd Die Another Day at 24, and I had Casino Royale 1967 at 23. So we have all of those.
Yeah.
And that World Is Not Enough, I had at 22. Did you mention that one?
Yep.
For Your Eyes Only, you said, right?
Yep.
I have that at 21. So I think the only one I have that wasn't also in yours, my 20 is Quantum of Solace.
Oh, okay. And I have Quantum of Solace coming into the next grouping, but yeah, that's... So that's 27 through 20.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had Man with the Golden Gun, View to a Kill, and Diamonds Are Forever. I had all of those at 1.5 on Letterboxd. And then after that, it goes into 2 to 2.5.
Yeah.
So, not too far after Quantum of Solace, you're actually going to get into movies that I like. So, I mean, there's a decent amount that I like.
The next grouping is the biggest one because if you've been listening, 3 and 3.5 are the most, used ratings. And actually, you know what? I did make a mistake. Well, okay. It's still going to be outside the top 20. So Quantum of Solace will come right after this. It's 19. Mm-hmm. I had the rating by it, but I did not group it with all the others. So Quantum of Solace would be 19. Then Never Say Never Again, I have at 18. Mainly on the strength of Barbara Carrera's performance. I'm always going to look fondly on Never Say Never Again just because of her.
I mean, I could probably watch it again just to watch her. I might turn it off after she dies, but I could watch it up to that point. Yeah.
Number 17, I have Dr. No, probably the averagest Bond there is, if you just take them all as a whole.
I do. I have that one a little higher, but not too much.
16, I have The Living Daylights. Is that 16? 19, 18, 17? Yeah, 16, I have The Living Daylights. Mm-hmm. 15, License to Kill. 14, Live and Let Die, which was the one that had the great opening half and the bad mm-hmm. second half. I could see that going either way, but that's where I ended up on that one. So Live and Let Die is 14. Octopussy is the 13th. I have Spectre at 12, On Her Majesty's Secret Service at 11, and Moonraker at 10. And we still have threes to go, so... that's where I go to my from 19 to 10.
Yeah, I had so Quantum of Solace was my 20th. So I had Spectre at 19.
Okay.
You Only Live Twice, I have at 18.
Mm-hmm.
Never Say Never Again, I have at 17. We both have Living Daylights at 16.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow Never Dies, I have at 15. You haven't said that one yet.
I have
right?
that one up higher, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have License to Kill and Live and Let Die a little higher, too. Mm-hmm. I have Octopussy at 14. I actually have No Time to Die at 13.
Oh, okay.
Dr. No at 12. Thunderball, I have at 11.
Hmm.
And then we both have Moonraker at 10.
Okay. And that's interesting, you know, but, you know, that you have No Time to Die lower on your list, but I have it higher on my list, and you like No Time to Die more than I do. So that's kind of an interesting thing.
I will say starting at Living Daylights, you're getting into three stars for me. So starting at like the top 16 or three stars and above.
Mm-hmm. So let's see, that was 19 through 10. I said Moonraker was my 10.
Yeah.
So I have No Time to Die at 9, Thunderball at 8, Tomorrow Never Dies at 7, nice. Goldfinger at 6, From Russia with Love at 5, Goldeneye at 4, Skyfall at 3, The Spy Who Loved Me at 2, and Casino Royale at 1, the 2006 Casino Royale at number 1.
That is a very fair number 1. A lot of people have that at number 1.
Mm-hmm. It was between that and The Spy Who Loved Me, which, before starting this up, I had The Spy Who Loved Me at number 1. After considering both movies in a recent viewing, I have now got Casino Royale ahead of it.
Honestly, my top 3... any of those could be number 1. It's mm-hmm. fine. You know, like I wouldn't, you know, it might be the day you asked me about it. I've got Live and Let Die at 9. So I like that a little. I thought it was what was good.
Yeah.
Propped it up a little bit for me. Goldeneye at 8. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, Tomorrow Never Dies, I like that you have it Tomorrow Never Dies was probably for me the biggest surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Cause yeah. I really didn't remember liking that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up being pretty damn good. Anyways, Live and Let Die at 9, Goldeneye at 8, the best Brosnan, easily, even though mm-hmm. Tomorrow Never Dies is pretty good. I've got From Russia with Love at 7, and I've actually got On Her Majesty's Secret Service at 6.
Yeah.
If that's Connery, I think that might be the number 1.
Mm-hmm.
It's very possible.
That's how good that movie is on its own. Yeah.
I've got Skyfall at 5. So the biggest one we disagree on, I've got License to Kill at 4.
Oh, yeah, actually, okay.
Now that I'm thinking about it, I probably would put Skyfall ahead of that. I don't really know why. I probably could switch those. But regardless, mm-hmm. that's what I have right now. I have Casino Royale at 3. Mm-hmm. I have Goldfinger at 2. And I have Spy Who Loved Me at 1. Those mm-hmm. 3, for me, are easily the top 3. And I mm-hmm. think any of those could be number 1 for me. Mm-hmm. Were those your top 3, too? Was Goldfinger a third? No, Goldfinger's lower for you, right?
Yeah, Goldfinger's at 6. I think the removal of Bond from the action for the most part of Goldfinger sort of drops it for me, and the villain plan is so weird to me, but I like Goldfinger quite a bit. From Russia with Love, I think, which I have at 5, From Russia with Love was a little bit better than I remembered seeing the first time.
Oh, gotcha.
But I have in my top 4, Goldeneye is 4, Skyfall's mm-hmm. 3, Spy Who Loved Me's 2, Casino Royale's at 1. The Spy Who Loved Me has been consistently at near the top mm-hmm. during
for me too.
During both of the runs of Bond that I had. This is the first Bond run through that I've done where I've gotten to see the Craigs again.
Yeah.
After my initial viewing of The Spy Who Loved Me back in the day, I had that number one on my list. And Casino Royale, if you had asked me before this started, I would have probably put it, I don't know, 3-4, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. But there was something about watching it again. Really enjoyed it. So
it's excellent. By the way, I did switch License to Kill and Skyfall. But I mean, The Spy Who Loved Me and Goldfinger, it could be. I've seen those a lot more. Those have been with me a lot longer. I don't know. But Casino Royale, I mean, it's 17 years old or whatever at this point. So It's not like that's recency bias or anything.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess if I was going to sit down, I just kind of thought, which ones would I put on first? Goldfinger was my favorite for the longest time, actually. That was the one I watched a lot. Mm-hmm. Spy Who Loved Me, just, I don't know, there's something about Spy Who Loved Me. It's just, I feel like it captures both sides of the Bond films. Like, it's a little dark at times. It's tragic, but also it's fun. It's funny. You know, it kind of captures, like, both sides of Bond, which I feel like No Time to Die in times is doing a really good job of that, but then it just kind of falls short. And
it's interesting. I spent this whole podcast talking about how I don't like No Time to Die, and ends up ninth on my list of and I think there's an interesting thing that happens when you're watching this. There is some recency bias because the modern movies, every Daniel Craig movie has looked fantastic. They have gotten the best cinematographers on these things. They all look great. They don't look like
better
directors. They don't look like they're going to age like horribly in the next 20 years. So you're watching movies that are just very well made, very technically well made. And it's hard to shake that when you're watching these. Yeah. Even if you're not liking the story, there's other things to really like about all the Daniel Craigs. And so that's what ends up happening. A movie that you're kind of down on ends up in a 27 movie series ends up being in the top 10. So,
well, and I also think maybe there's only like 3 or 4 of these that are actually like great. And then after that, you've just got a lot of like, these are good.
Yeah,
and it's just kind of however you feel like, which one would you watch if you had a choice?
Right.
Honor of Majesty's Secret Service, though, might be, it's also one of the best, it's also one of the most irritating, because like I said, if you had a different actor in there that actually won, because I think Lazenby, not only is he not great in it, but I think part of the problem is he just didn't really enjoy it. Like, he just didn't really like acting, which is why he didn't sign that contract. And
that's one that's fallen the most for me after the second viewing, is Honor of Majesty's Secret Service. I think when I ranked these, back in the day, I had Honor Majesty's Secret Service in the top 5 because it was a surprise for me. But watching it again, the Lazenby thing is hard to ignore.
It is.
When you're watching this. But Diana Rigg is probably the first female in a Bond that's treated with any kind of respect. I guess Goldfinger, Honor Blackman and Pussy Galore. But the problem is, for me, with her character in that movie, is that he just force kisses her, and then she's like, okay, I'll do whatever you want, James Bond. And it's like, it's probably one of the most annoying things.
She might be gay. Like, yeah. I get the impression she's supposed to be gay.
Yeah,
so
that's what I understand from that, too. Yeah. So it's one of those things where it's like, finally, someone who, you know, is doing their own thing, and they're not worried about what Bond's going to do. And then they totally ruin that character by the end of it. So, so I think Diana Rigg's the first one that comes off with any, like, just comes off the best, the first one that comes off the best, in that series. And it was really high.
She does everything she can to help Lazenby, like try to make it, you know, I mean, she really tries, but they have no chemistry.
No,
I mean, Eva Green is easily, I think, the best female lead in a Bond film.
I agree with that.
Diana Rigg might be second.
Mm-hmm.
It's very possible. I mean, I'd have to think about that for a second. But I would take Diana Rigg over Honor Blackman, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think Diana Rigg's a better actor, first off. I mean, I think that's part of it. Honor Blackman's not terrible, but, I mean, she's just not... But then you have something like The Spy Who Loved Me, which is awesome, but I don't really... Barbara Bach's not great in that role. Like, but it's a pretty decent role.
Yeah. But at least there's a character that's you know, that does spy stuff and is not just a damsel in distress. Yeah.
Yeah, and she looks the part. And, I mean, her and Roger Moore actually do have chemistry. And, you know, or at least a little bit, you know. So it doesn't really bother me the way Lazenby's performance bothers me. But that is huge. You are absolutely correct. That is a huge thing. But you're right. The Craig films look better. Because even, like, Goldfinger could... It looks like an episode of Columbo sometimes. Like, it's just... A lot of 60s movies are like that, though. A lot of 60s movies have that, like... Because 60s television... I think television started looking better in the 60s. And then... But then the movies kind of resemble the television. It's weird. So... Mm-hmm. But, you know, I agree. When you're watching the Craig films, they feel like... I get why people like... especially younger people. I mean, that's going to be their bond. I totally get it. Because they do look amazing. I just don't necessarily have that attachment to them that I would have had to some of the other ones when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
Which is totally... I mean, that's fair. It's like people that grew up with the Star Wars prequels. And, you know, they really love Revenge of the Sith or whatever in a way that I'm never going to. Just because it's just different. For whatever reason. But, and they're wrong.
Yes, and they're wrong. That's the end of the show. They're wrong. Mm-hmm.
But I guess we do need to wrap this up. This has been a lot of fun. I hope everybody out there has enjoyed this. We'll be back in some form or fashion, I think, at some point, even if it's just for a new Bond film, you know. Mm-hmm. But hopefully you'll keep subscribed to us. So if anything ever, you know, when we start doing something else, it'll pop right back up in your feed. Also, before we go, we have social media. You can reach us on Twitter. We are at GoldSpy007. You can also reach out to me directly on Twitter. I am at SamLoomis13. You can email us at golddiamonddeath007@gmail.com. And if you like this podcast and other things under the CinemaSins brand, we also have a Patreon you can join at patreon.com/CinemaSins. And if you have a second to leave us a 5-star review at your podcast listening app of choice, we would appreciate it. Thank you for joining us this week. We hope you will join us again for any future endeavors we partake on this podcast. But until then, keep the martinis dry and shaken, the Baccarat shoe moving, and the Aston Martin fully gassed. This is Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins signing off, and we will see you next mission.